Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Max Carlin, and I'm joined as always by Jake Rosen. Jake, how you doing?
I'm doing well today, Max. How are you? I'm glad to be back.
I'm doing well because I'm excited for this episode. We are joined again by Henry Ward to talk some team building. Henry, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Max, and I want to give you a shout out because the intros are getting cleaner and cleaner with every future episode, so congrats.
It's so nerve-wracking. I'm just, like, positive that I'm going to mess it up every time. And then every time I get through it, well, I guess I've only gotten through it, like, once or twice without messing up now.
Yeah, Max is getting more comfortable, sadly, to the detriment of my entertainment every week, but...
Yeah, I could start concocting... We'll applaud him. I could start concocting mess-ups.
No, nah, it's way content. Better when it's natural. It's got to be natural.
All right, so we brought Henry on because Henry has, I think, really interesting philosophical views on how to go about team building. So we're going to talk about that kind of broadly and then applying it to the draft context in general, because I think that there are maybe some issues that crop up that we're gonna get into with actually trying to realize this approach. And then we're going to apply it to the 2021 draft some, because there are some relevant guys for this sort of view of team building. So Henry, do you want to just give the whole spiel on how you think you should go about building winning teams in the NBA?
Sure, gladly. I mean, I'm happy to go on about it to anyone who's ready to listen. But I'll try and keep it somewhat brief. I've written a lot about it, so there's always a reference point of just going to my Twitter and looking at my blog, which has a couple articles written about it. But basically, I just operate from the premise, the two sort of overarching objectives in team building and putting together a winning product in the court is maximizing space offensively and minimizing space defensively. So basically, where you kind of end up after that, after kind of thinking through what the best way to do that is, you know, barring sort of like the unicorn type prospects of like Anthony Davis, Evan Mobley, even Chet Holmgren, who's relevant today. The most sort of optimal skill sets to do that on both ends are found in what we kind of consider wings, who are kind of like, you know, bigger than typical guards, but more athletic, more agile than typical bigs. And with their skill set often sort of being a mesh between sort of the best parts of guards offensively and the best parts of bigs defensively, obviously to sort of measured extents. Like they're not, wings often aren't handling the ball as well as smaller lead guards are, one-way lead guards, I should say. And they aren't protecting the rim as well as sort of the bigger, you know, rim protecting centers are, obviously. But they're sort of the matrix where those two skill sets sort of combined. And not to mention sort of how shooting plays into that, which is important, but we'll get to something about shooting later. But basically sort of beyond that, when you're hunting wings, sort of what do you want to be looking for? To me, the most viable thing you can have on the court is five guys who are all processing the game faster than the other five guys they're playing. Regardless of sort of how, not regardless of, but I'm willing to sacrifice certain skill deficiencies in order to create that product, because I believe through history, we have seen, not through history, but through recent history, we have seen the most successful teams that outperform their sort of perceived skill level are doing so because they have that hyper level processing across their all, every kind of lineup they basically roll out. And obviously every lineup is really hard to come by. Like creating a roster of like nine of these guys is very difficult, which I'm sure we'll touch on. But maximizing it as best you can is sort of the easiest way to, I guess, get the most out of the players you have on the court. And so basically from that premise, sort of how at least in my draft philosophy most is I'm kind of willing to prioritize the highest skill guys more than the consensus. And I'm willing to pass on or miss out on the highest skill guys that are pretty low feel relative to consensus. Basically the way I see it, kind of to extrapolate it out to a difficult thing, it's hard to explain on a podcast, but if we're trying to make it sort of like visual, actually Sean Darenthal of Ode to Odin, who now does the Stephian Draft podcast, did a very good job outlining this sort of idea in his recent James Booknight episode talking about creation thresholds. I think it applies pretty similarly to like feel thresholds, I guess you'd call it, where you know, you can picture a graph with two lines sort of parallel going upwards, and you know, as feel increases, so does the sort of impact to your team. But those lines begin to separate further down the graph you go, because the higher feel you get, the more compound, it's sort of like an exponential return situation where the higher the feel is, once you reach, you know, certain thresholds, the returns begin to double, triple on themselves. And the same applies to a team context, where if you have two guys who are super high feel, there's a big difference between having two guys that are super high feel and three guys. And the difference between three and four guys is even bigger. So finding a way to compile basically, so it's a situation where you have four to five very high processing, high feel guys on the court together at the same time is very important to me. And so that's sort of something I actively seek in scouting, is like, who are those guys who have that sort of preternatural feel and processing and can couple it with some sort of value add beyond that, right? Like if you're not going to play basketball very well beyond that, it's not really worth it. But willing to sacrifice some, you know, quote unquote value, I guess you could say, in the draft, targeting those players over maybe more skilled players, just because I think that the final product looks much better when you actively target those type of guys.
Is there a general point at which you start to believe that the, say, on-ball creation ability of a prospect at the top of the draft is no longer worth it if they are maybe a lower feel player? Like, where do you draw that threshold? Because I know that you acknowledge that sort of that on-ball creation is necessary, especially when defenses ratchet up in the playoffs. But so where is that line for you that you start to discount that creation enough?
The line sort of moves as the level of feel moves with the creation value, right? So like if there is, it's gotta be a nice coupling of both processing and on ball juice. And I would not, you know, the higher feel a guy has, the less on ball juice I'm looking for. And the more on ball juice a guy has, the less feel I'm looking for, I guess you could say. So like one guy that you and I have talked about a lot, Max, is Jalen Green. And like, he very closely teeters that line for me. And is honestly, I've sort of like semi flipped the switch with him philosophically. In terms of like earlier this year, I couldn't really see myself ever drafting a guy like that, but beginning to sort of come around on how dramatic the space creation is, how dramatic the shot making could be down the line, to where the point of like, you could teach him how to play basketball, you know, quote unquote, how to play basketball. You could teach him how to process things quickly enough so that it's worth investing in that sort of shot making. So it varies case to case. It's hard to like give a like actual rubric, but would say that like generally you're sort of looking to couple those things as best you can. And being, you know, exceptionally skilled in one lets you is a funny way to say it, but lets you sort of skip by on the lacking in the other to a certain extent too.
Yeah. So, I'll go ahead. I just wanted to hit on the point of Jalen Green, because I know, Henry, that's someone we talked about on our locker room show last week. And it's someone who we're both on the same side of the coin from an evaluative standpoint and identifying the skills that he has and the areas need to improve. But I think I'm definitely more into spending a higher draft capital on him than you are. And a big part of that is I definitely subscribe to a lot of the points and the overall basis of prioritizing high field players and surrounding those guys with as many, putting as many of them on the floor as possible. But at some point, like Max said, and I hate using the word threshold because we all three of us talk about this all the time, is there's always a way to compensate. There's not necessarily a bar that you have to hit where you have to clear it. And I think with someone like Jalen Green, he does possess an extremely high skill level and has the tools to take that game to the next level, but we can all agree he lacks the feel and the playmaking isn't necessarily there and the reads aren't there yet. But what I would say to you is, given that we have seen some high skill players, and this is a little bit along the lines of what we talked about last week, but I kind of want to dive deeper into it. Given that we've seen some extremely high skill guys make some, and I do want to say they're incremental. Like, we have never seen a high skill guy become Chris Paul passing the basketball. It just doesn't happen. However, there is a certain level you can reach where it makes the whole package viable and the feel and the playmaking is good enough. So how do you go about evaluating that from a player development standpoint? And if we're looking multiple years down the line?
That's a really good question. So I should probably mention, I don't want to go too much into this because I could talk forever about it, but if you want to look more into it, I have like my Exposing the Blueprint blogs up that explain it. But basically, part of the necessity for seeking out a certain requisite level of feel is based on the idea that the best way to drive offense at any level of basketball, college, high school, youth, NBA, whatever it is teaching sets of principles more than teaching sets of plays or actions. And basically that your objective on offense, the overarching objective beyond, you know, like the grander overarching objective of maximizing space, is to create like a flow state where all five players are sort of based in the same set of ideas so that they all know what the other four players will be doing in a certain moment. And the other four players know what the ball handler is doing in a certain moment and what the other, you know, three players beyond the ball handler are going to be doing. That's when you get like the beauty of, you know, the gorgeous like 2016 Warriors, like the Gonzaga team from this last year, like to differing extents, obviously, but like that should be the overarching goal. It's not saying, you know, here are these plays that we have to get these shots. I mean, if you make this percentage of shots, we'll win the game. It's, you know, we want these types of shots, not like these exact shots. We want like these are the buckets of shots that we want. Here are ideas that we can play with that will get us those shots over time. And then variance will play how it plays. So with that in mind, I fear taking gambles on guys who don't reach a certain requisite level of feel, because then they tank that entire idea by themselves. It only takes like one horrible link to tank that entire idea. Four guys can only buoy it so much. But if you have four super high feel guys and one guy who's like trying or like is coming around, is not like a lost cause, like a Cam Thomas, then you'll be fine. Like, I think then you can have, and especially if that guy's like Jalen Green, right? Who's like potential to be like a really good high level, like scoring champion type player. Then it's worth sort of like being like, all right, Jalen's going to like miss these relocations. He's going to miss these passing windows. Like, that'll happen, but it's worth it because over time he's going to generate enough offense for us that it'll pay off. But that's sort of my biggest hump to get over, is like understanding, can a guy not tank a flow state offense? And I was originally concerned that Jalen Green would be tanking a flow state offense. But as I sort of came around, saw some of how, I think Ignite was also a tough situation just because so much of their evaluative context was just like me, you, like Kuminga and Jalen Green, like who's taking it now? Like it doesn't promote any of that thinking, but you saw some flashes from whether it be pacing the pick and roll, sneaky pick and rolls to take space. Like there's some level of reasoning that's happening and court mapping that's happening that would allow him sort of the baseline skills to be able to sort of engage in offense like that. So I think it just requires a sort of like evaluative statements on minutia and whether you think that really can a guy just not be a disaster. And if he's not a disaster and he's as good as Jalen Green is at scoring a basketball, then it makes sense at a certain point.
Yeah. It's a shame to like mess up a really easy transition there into talking about some examples, and that you mentioned the Warriors, Gonzaga, and I think we're going to talk about the Heat as well. But I do want to put you on the spot with one question to find out how much of an extremist you are with this philosophy. So hypothetically, if you had, and these are like kind of ridiculous groupings of skills, but if you hypothetically had a 100th percentile field player who is 50th percentile on ball creator and a 100th percentile on ball creator, 50th percentile field, which one are you taking?
I think it depends on where I'm at contextually with the team a lot, but I would say generally, it's tough. This is like kind of the answering this question or deciding how I answer the question will ultimately decide like how I rank the guys from like 4 to 10 in this draft. But I think ultimately I do lean, this is kind of a hot take. Well, I guess 100th percentile both ways is tough, but I do think that you generally are able to find way more 75th percentile on ball scorers than you are 75th percentile field guys. Obviously percentile is like relative to the group that you're studying, but like theoretically in basketball, like I think you get some really, really good on ball scorers every draft, a couple or a handful of so. Whether you won't bet on them being that long term is whatever, but you get like some flashes. Whereas like the super high field guys, you get like one or two a draft, if that. And so I would take the field guy, especially like size would be a big a variable in that sort of equation. But generally I think I would go with the field guy, barring that, like, you know, I was starting from ground zero, I could be convinced to take the high school guy, but if it's like not the absolute tank I'm in, then I would probably go with the field guy.
Yeah. I think that the like avoiding answering it is probably the move, because it depends a lot on what you have. Because if you already have a guy in place who can shoulder a massive amount of on-ball load at a really high level, then maybe there's more of an argument. But to me, just the sustainability of the offense that you get from Kevin Durant, the whole appeal is that the shots are always the same. And they're tough shots, but they're elite offense, always. And I think that is, you know, kind of what makes those guys a trump card in the playoffs, that you can just sustain that offense because the shots are the same. So I tend to
think that way. Quickly, I just pulled up Tankathon because I think this is a fun thought experiment of like how many teams right now in the lottery would I take which one for. I think really the only teams I'd opt for the creator type for are like Detroit, Orlando. That's like maybe it. Because I'm looking at like, I'd rather have, for example, the Thunder and the Rockets. I'd rather have Scottie Barnes rolled out than Jalen Green, because I just think that if you have Shea, you have Kevin Porter Jr., like those are your primaries of the future. Shoot, you're just surrounding them with high field guys. Like that's what you want to create. It's just a high field environment. So I want to take the high field guy. You look at teams like, you know, Cleveland desperately needs that type of player. Sacramento desperately needs that type of player. Minnesota desperately needs that type of player. So I think it just also speaks to the dearth of those types of players in general. So if you have your chance at one, you got to take it.
Or the dearth of them on bad teams.
True. That's very true. Yeah. Which is telling. I think that helps too.
Yeah. I think it's probably a little bit more varied than you do, but I think it's a worthwhile point because it's definitely true for some of those teams.
Yeah. And you brought up a great word that I was going to bring up and harp on later in the podcast, insulate. And I think that's maybe where I might be, if we're imagining this as like a political spectrum, like I might be a little bit more towards the middle and less extremist than you, Henry. And the reason for that would be, I do believe there is a high ceiling to a team or a particular lineup that has four of these guys and one player that, like Max said, obviously Kevin Durant, we're talking about an otherworldly shot creator and offensive scorer, but just kind of taking that same approach of, hey, when the shot clock's running down or when the playoffs and defenses are really tightening up and schemes are pinpoint accurate, we're going to need someone who's going to be able to go get theirs. And as true hooper and corny as that sounds, it does carry a little bit of weight for me at least. And so what I would say is, how do you approach chasing? What I would say is, me personally, I view having five pure field guys and four field guys and one guy to shoulder the offense. I sort of view those as equally high-end outcomes for something that I'm chasing in team building. Do you always shoot to prioritize all five, or are you, I don't even want to say content. Basically what I'm getting at is, do you feel that having a lineup that insulates one high level creator is a step down from the all five high field guys?
Well, this is also an interesting point because I think it requires us to maybe consider what makes all of, like, the high level creators we're all okay with running an offense in the championship, what's in common with all of them, which is they're the rare crux of high feel and high skill. Like, they're all the guys you named are all players I would consider, like, that kind of high feel that would fit in. Like, you would have five high feel guys if your initiator is Luka, Steph, LeBron, Harden, Durant, like, teeters on it. Name whoever else. That's why those teams are so good that they run, is because they're both.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at Bet Online. Bet Online is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, Bet Online gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
So to me, it's like, you know, the conversations we have specifically in this draft, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more, but they are, I think Jalen Green's going to be our proxy for most of the day, which is fine. But like, Jalen Green's ceiling is not that. It's not the top 10 player in the league for that exact reason. His ceiling is all-star scorer, who's a great, you know, fantastic number two, number three next to someone like that. So you still have to, I think, you know, we're yet to see, we'll talk about the Heat in a little bit, but we have to see a team really be carried by one of these sort of median feel on-ball creators. That doesn't really happen. They're more an ancillary piece on a championship team. So I think that's part of it too. I think it's interesting. I don't disagree with you, Jake, by the way. I think that if you're able to surround, you know, there's a lot of nuance in this conversation that naturally gets left out because it's, you know, we're talking to each other on an hour long podcast. But that there is some sort of, like, I think you could craft a team based around a Zach LaVine, a Jalen Green type, with four super high fill guys who are also very talented, maybe not star level talents, but super talented, borderline all-star types, whatever, where you can compete for a championship that way. It's all about, you know, just putting the puzzle together. So I just do think that was an interesting point you brought up, because I do think that reflects the importance of feel, is you can't really be run by a guy who doesn't have that level of feel and be successful.
I feel like we're getting into this now, so we might as well just do this before we talk about some of the examples. But how weak link of an approach do you think this is? Because clearly, like, you can't have someone out there who is totally clueless, because it will just disjoint everything. But, like, you know, what's the minimum level that you need to attain? Like, how much does this actually hinge on having that high level of feel across all five players on the floor?
Well, I think that the more you prioritize it, the better returns you'll get. So I think that there is, I'm confident that a team that, you know, was a 50th percentile talent team, quote unquote, that was also full of, you know, five guys in the 90th percentile of field would outperform sort of how they were expected to perform before they were all put together on the same team. So to extrapolate from that, I think that it's all a balance, but I do think that there is, there are certain players I just wouldn't seek out in team. Like, if I was a GM, I wouldn't consider, because I just would rather have a player that's, like, slightly worse, quote unquote, that fits this better. Like, an example, I'm trying to think of, like, what a worthwhile example would be. Honestly, the Jazz this year are, like, a good example of making some of the parts greater than the whole, or other way around. I messed up that saying. But if you prioritize those sort of things, you know, the Jazz could have hunted, like, I'm not gonna be able to come up with NBA examples, but more like, you know, juicier, like high scoring wings instead of Royce O'Neal and Joe Ingles. And everyone would have looked and been like, oh, what a great signing for the Jazz. Like, so-and-so averaged, you know, 22 points per game on whatever else team last year. And Royce O'Neal is like a role player. Haha. Well, the returns are happening because Royce O'Neal and Joe Ingles are both like amongst, you know, Mike Conley, Donovan Mitchell, Gobert, whoever else, are all those sort of high level thinkers. So yes, there is some sort of weak link to it. But again, it just depends on like the talent level it's given at any given point.
Yeah, I'm just a little suspicious that it's a little more weak link than you let on, because if you take Steph Curry and Draymond Green, two all-time intellects, and you put them on this year's Warriors, it's not necessarily that good. And that's like a, you know, a team that I would say like notably is lacking in high field players outside of two all-timers there.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, I actually think so. Yeah. Maybe I misrepresented myself. I think that there is fully a pretty low threshold for what the weak link can be. A pretty high threshold for what the weak link can be. Drafting James Wiseman and investing in Andrew Wiggins is the best way to possibly tank a team with Steph Curry and Draymond Green on it. Like, I couldn't have drawn a better way to tank that team for that exact reason. Like, I would have just surrounded them with a bunch of like average, you know, quote unquote average players that all would have just been willing to like catch it, whip, like just swing the ball around the perimeter, cut when you need to cut, cover rotation, we need to cover rotation. You don't even have to dribble. Just like pass when you want to pass, shoot when you're open, cut when you're open, and let Steph and Draymond do everything. Obviously that's like a utopian way of looking at things, but like I would have rather had that than had Andrew Wiggins and James Wiseman running around. So yeah, I think I might have been misleading. I think there is a pretty high threshold for the weak link, and I do think that it's definitely worthwhile at a certain point to seek, you know, worse players that think better and react better than better players who don't think that way.
Yeah. And we can talk later about how possible actually doing that is, but yeah, I mean, let's talk about a few examples of teams that kind of realized your philosophy. And so the first is the old Warriors. And I think like the epitome of it is actually probably pre Durant. It's the, you know, it's that the 16 Warriors team that won 73 games. And it was just, the, you know, the optionality that they had in everything that they did, this idea that everyone at all times is making a ton of decisions, processing a ton of information, and there are all of these different things that you can do because of that, because everyone's always reading what's happening and adjusting to it. It produces beautiful basketball. It produces, you know, the best offense ever. But I think that like one of the major issues that I have, at least, is what percentage of that is simply that you have Stephen Curry, and that when he runs off of a pin down or split cuts or whatever it may be, he creates complete havoc, and, you know, enables the situation where there are these advantages that are created off the ball, so more or less because he exists, that these other players who are intelligent, you know, can capitalize on, but they don't exist without Steph Curry.
Yeah, I mean, to win an NBA championship, you have to have either, you know, the best player in the league that year, or some combination of two to three of like the top 10 players in the league that year. So I think like the championship heuristic is a difficult one, because one team wins it every year, and like often it's the same teams competing for it. So yes, you're to get to this level of, to win a championship with this type of play, you still need like generational talent on the team. It's not like you're just going to win a championship with a bunch of average Joes who are playing this way. I do think it's like, I find this team so fascinating for so many reasons. And every so often I'm in a situation like this where I feel compelled to Google the roster again. And I will read you this roster, and granted, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green are all on it. As is, you know, obviously a very good Andre Iguodala. But this was an NBA champ, or, you know, a 73-win team in the NBA. Leandro Barbosa, Harrison Barnes, Andrew Bogut, Ian Clark, Steph, Festus Ezeli, Draymond, Andre, Sean Livingston, Kevon Looney, James McAdoo, Brandon Rush, Maurice Spates, Jason Thompson, Anderson Varejao, and Clay. Like, that team overachieved, I think it's fair to say, to some extent. Based on maybe.
You have guys submitting cases for the greatest offensive season ever and one of the greatest defensive seasons ever.
Right, but those things I don't think can be separated from the greater situation they're in. To a large extent, they deserve a lot of credit for the individual efforts they put in. But if that's Steph Curry, that version of Steph Curry is being put in the Terry Stotts school of 40-foot high ball screens every game, and Draymond is simply a short roll guy, and Clay is a spot up guy who occasionally comes off like double drags, like, does that team perform the same way? I don't know. I think it's both, obviously. That's not like a revolutionary thought. But there is obviously a certain level of like exceptional individual talent that's required to win an NBA championship, no matter how you want to go about team building or coaching or whatever. And that's what, you know, Steph is the reason that that team won a championship. But I don't think it is sort of, you know, separable from how the team ran its entire system, which was, if you catch the ball and you're not shooting, you're moving. If you get off the ball, you're moving. It just made, we all know what it looked like, right? Like, it was the prettiest offense in NBA history by a lot. And it reminds you of, like, you know, the early 2010s, like late 2000s Spurs, like all these teams we think of as like, and we'll get into more of this, I'm sure, when we talk about other examples, but like all these teams we think of as like, that team played such beautiful offense. That was like the peak of basketball. That's such fun basketball to play. They all do the same sort of thing. It's all this sort of offense. It's all like high movement, high motion, quick decisions, reactivity, low set plays. They don't look that way. Like, I don't think this is a revolutionary idea in terms of how you build a winning offense. I think we've seen it time and again. We can talk more about the Heat and Gonzaga and the Jazz. Like, every team that has some level of talent and builds a team with this ideal in mind and then executes on the court finds a relative level of success compared to the talent they have. That's kind of the crux of my argument. But yeah, to answer more fully, sure, you do need, like, to win a championship, you're always going to need high-level talent. It's not going to just come with any kind of system. But with that in mind, when you have the high-level talent, I think you can maximize it this way.
So something that jumped out to me when you were reading off that roster, and especially because I was planning to ask about them, about this particular role, when I came across Gonzaga, because I just finished up a Gonzaga game and had a thought that popped out. The big men on that team, Festus Ezeli, Andrew Bogut, and one more, Kevon Looney. So out of all the guys that had offensive touches and prioritized looks, those three we cannot pretty much all agree were towards the bottom end of the spectrum. And this is something that I was thinking about with Gonzaga, as great of college production players Drew Timmy was. When Gonzaga's offense faltered, it was mainly because Drew Timmy was forcing post looks and had tunnel vision. And so what I'm kind of asking you is, we've talked about hunting wings because they are typically the best just based on sheer size, skill, and feel combination. They're typically the best at, like you said, the 2 points, maximizing space offensively and minimizing space defensively. I was going to ask you, where do you feel big men fit into this? Because as someone who typically I get grilled in my DMs and mentions for basically hating on big men other than Evan Mobley, Nikola Jokic, and Joel Embiid, I personally kind of have moved away from prioritizing them with high draft capital. And that's why I was out on someone like James Wiseman. People talk to me about Isaiah Stewart all the time. Like, Isaiah Stewart's still not someone I have a ton of FOMO on, despite him pretty much overachieving in his rookie year. So my question to you would be, where do you feel big men fit into this overall offensive approach, and how do you go about prioritizing, whether it's getting them through the draft or in free agency, and how do you really go about filling out the roster? Because at the end of the day, we can all agree there is a requisite level of rim protection that is needed in the NBA. So as much as we'd love to go straight small ball and maximize out on versatility and creation, it's somewhat not feasible on the other end.
For sure. And I think, so there's a few answers to this. First, I'll start off and say that team's ability for those three big men specifically to succeed partially relied on having someone like Steph. So I give, sort of going back to the last conversation we had, that is the flexibility an offensive talent like Steph gives you, is you can roll out sort of the big-ish, sort of slower guys like that and not have any spacing problems because you're always going to have two guys chasing Steph. So all those guys' jobs were was basically like dunk the open dunk or pass it if it wasn't open, which granted they were pretty good at, but just like on offense it was that easy, which many times if you don't have a Steph-like player, it's not going to be that easy. Second part of that question, I guess, or answer is – we can find a lot of those guys, which I think you kind of hinted at, Jake. A lot of those guys can be mid-level exception guys. They can be not really UDFAs. I think you can kind of get like the occasional one like Freddie Gillespie. But they're just a lower they're less scarce in terms of their sort of market valuation. So you can get, you know, you can get Marc Gasol on the veterans minimum. You can get Aaron Baines on a 1-year deal. You can get, you know, so if you want that sort of spacing, immobile big, that's sort of that decently high feel, very high feel in the case of Gasol, like you can find them. And then third of all, sort of like to get into the actual draft philosophy, I think it's very worthwhile to invest in quote unquote bigs who have those sort of wing-ish skill sets, not wings. Like saying they have wing skill sets is unfair to them because calling Scottie Barnes a wing is not, you're going to be disappointed. But the reason I have, you know, I love Mobley so much, why I have Scottie Barnes, the top five pick, et cetera. Why I think even I said this on the other podcast today, like I could easily see Kai Jones being out of the league in 3 years, and I would still take him in the lottery without question because there's a chance he's one of these guys, which is the occasional player who moves like a guard, can space a floor, can attack a closeout with a requisite level of skill, pass out advantages, and still be big enough and tall enough to like have a more traditional rim protector role where it's not really sort of rim protection by democracy, where it's more of like a funnel it to me and I'll handle it type of rim protection. That's so valuable. And I think we'll talk about this more with Bam. Like, that's why Bam is the Heat in my kind of general estimation. Like, that nothing happens last year without Bam, and nothing happens going forward without Bam. And I would max out Bam so fast, and obviously they did, and a lot of teams agree with me. It's not like a hot take, but just like he's having that type of player is so valuable. So when you reach that level, I'm really, really happy to invest early and often and maybe even overpay for that type of player. Because there's so few of them and what they do for you is so great. But beyond that, I wouldn't really, you know, I'm not like grabbing straws at someone like De'Aaron Sharp, who maybe has it, maybe doesn't, maybe not to like a real worthwhile level, but shows flashes. Like, I'll just pass on that. Let me get that in free agency.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at Bet Online. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point because all of these, the three teams that we have to talk about are that Warriors team, the Heat, and Gonzaga this past year. And I think they have two things in common. One being a big man who is skilled enough to handle the ball and is intelligent enough to process a ton of information and make a ton of decisions, and is skilled enough as a passer to execute passes. All those teams have that in common. And then the other thing that they have is a true, what I said earlier was like a Havoc shooter. There are not a lot of those guys. There are maybe five of them in the entire NBA where them by existing, by relocating on the perimeter, by running off of the simplest of action, they you know, wreak havoc on the defense. And so it is, you know, Steph, Duncan Robinson, like not even anymore probably, but JJ Redick was like that. I think that maybe there are one or two other guys who fit onto like Davis Bertans or something like that. Gonzaga, of course, had Corey Kispert. I feel like that seems so crucial to me in actually unlocking this vision of basketball where there are all of these breakdowns that you can take advantage of off the ball to generate quality looks. Is that it does seem like it hinges maybe more than you're giving credit for on having that one guy who is a totally special game-changing shooter.
So, before Henry, do you mind if I make a quick point before you go?
Right.
Just I kind of feel obligated to speak on all the Gonzaga stuff because it's so fresh in my head. And what I will say about someone like Kispert is the thing that I find with shooters is oftentimes we can see some of the best offenses get stagnant when things are going tough. Michigan this year ran a great modern offense, tons of ball screens, spread pick and rolls, down screens, curls, you name it. And then when things got tough against UCLA, they all just froze. And there wasn't someone who was instigating the movement and starting back up these principles. And that's sort of a problem that you can run into, like Henry said, trying to avoid hard cut sets that are robotic and more relying on instincts and feel. And we can all agree that the benefits of relying on principles rather than sets are incrementally more rewarding, but there are times when offenses can get stagnant. And my overall point with Kispert is sending him off a curl or a flare, anything that starts the movement and it tilts the defense and it gets everyone going. And so I think that's maybe why shooters are so crucial. And just, I figured I'd make that point real quick.
Yeah, but it's not shooters though. It's the like special shooters who, as we talked about before, like don't come around once a draft. They come around once every 2-3, maybe more drafts. And sometimes they come from weird places like Duncan Robinson. Those guys are so hard to come by, and it feels, at least to me, like they're pretty central to this whole vision.
I think they're more central to the vision than I was maybe giving credit to before, but I don't know if they're so essential that they're like 1A to 1B with like having the mobile ball screen versatile handling big. Just because I think you can still see the effects of like a Jazz team that is getting looks. There's multiple ways to get like this end game formula. Like there's not one way of doing it. So like, you know, if you have a Donovan Mitchell type space creator, maybe you don't need the on-ball shooter. The Heat didn't have that. Gonzaga didn't have that. So maybe that's why they needed it more. I do think it is, you know, it does unlock a ton for you. Yeah, I guess my concern would just be I'm not hesitant to latch onto the idea as you guys have described, because you're absolutely right. I'm hesitant to really like dip my head into it because I feel like that's a great way to make some really bad value picks. Like we talk about Kispert. I don't know if Kispert's one of those guys, but he's clearly being treated as one of them. Happy to sort of like go into more of that when we talk next time. But just like, I don't know that Kispert is this like guy who can run off, you know, screens all day and then expect him to make 6 out of 11 threes like every other playoff game like Duncan Robinson was. However, I do agree that if you have a player that is that type of shooter, it is worth investing in. It's just a little trickier because, you know, for every Steph Curry, you have a Jimmer. So it's a little bit tougher. And like you said, and like you can pull guys like that out of nowhere sometimes, like Duncan. And it is crucial and extremely helpful, just a little bit hard to come by.
Yeah, and I think it is fair to suggest that, like, just because we haven't seen it yet, that it's not possible. Like, what if the off-ball habit creator is Zion curling into the lane? Like, it's believable to me. That would definitely make sense that starts movement enough and creates enough havoc in the defense that you're creating these creases that smart players can capitalize on. I definitely buy that. I think need to see it happen. And maybe historically there are more examples of it. Yeah, the last thing that I wanted to talk about at least briefly with these teams was, so Golden State obviously won a title pre-Durant and then they become a whole different beast. The Heat, you know, went on a crazy run. And Gonzaga was going into the national championship game was the greatest modern college basketball team ever, probably. And then fell very flat. And I think that a lot of that can probably be attributed to a lack of half-court on-ball creation. It's sad because it was a team that was such a like perfect articulation of this philosophy, right? That like you had this beautiful cutting all the time and the optionality in the offense and just smart players from, you know, down the entire roster. And then when they were pressured in the half court and taken out of their rhythm and someone had to create on the ball, they didn't have it. And it was not a close game.
Yes. Without a doubt, I hesitate to say they were that much of an, they were that emblematic because for that exact reason, because when they were forced in a half court setting, their principles were very, were pretty clearly, in my opinion, just like, we are going to run you off the court and we are perfectly apt to do so. And rightfully so, because for the first 34 games of the year, it didn't matter at all. And they were 100% right. But beyond that, maybe just out of lack of necessity, there was no infrastructure in place to handle any kind of stagnation. So as we saw in the national championship game, the response was, you know, oh, we're all freezing. We're freezing up. Like, we're down 14-0, whatever it was. Like, Timmy, like, let's just get the ball to Timmy. Just throw it in to Timmy. Throw it in to Timmy. It's like, that is the that is the exact opposite. That is the paradox of, like, what you were going for the entire year. Like, I know that you got slowed down, so your response had to be, it's not like you could just run on them all game, but, like, there are so many ways to create half-court advantages that don't require a ball screen and don't require a post-touch. That those are the avenues to explore, not like, oh, we need a run. Let's just funnel the ball into Timmy and take 16 seconds off the clock. Like, no, that is the opposite of what you need to be doing right now. But so in that case, I was yelling at my TV a lot because it was just like, this is not your identity. This is not why you're good all year. What are you doing? And I get the affinity to do so because there were plenty of times, like in the UCLA game, for example, where when things were tight, it's like, all right, entry pass to Timmy, get 2 points, and let's kind of recalibrate. And next possession, when there's a defensive rebound, then we'll run. But there was no, like, as I said before, there was no infrastructure in place to sort of have, you know, okay, we're getting slowed down. They're just loading up to the ball. They're stopping our semi-transition. What next? There was no next. It was just Timmy. Let's all go to Timmy. Like, I think if you had some sort of infrastructure in place with, you know, double drags, the pass and cut offense that we saw more from the Heat, more from the Warriors. Like, you know, the Heat are, the NBA, I think, is much slower than the college game, or can be. So, like, we saw in the playoffs, like, the Heat, the way they generated that sort of, all those advantages was just, like, running Hero and Duncan off of, like, action after action out of action. Like, Bam would hold the ball forever if he didn't get a look. Like, just continually, like, it was funny, just, like, roam around the perimeter, like, oh, let's go to the left wing. Nothing there. All right, we'll dribble, kick it out, dribble back to the right wing. Nothing there. Like, okay, now we'll go for a floater. Like, none of that was happening with Gonzaga. So I think there is a way to sort of manufacture half-court advantages that doesn't rely so heavily on semi-transition that Gonzaga just didn't ever touch on.
Yeah, so I think the national championship game was really interesting for a couple of reasons. And one, I was talking about with some other people, it's Gonzaga and Michigan suffered from the same thing when I already hinted at it in the UCLA game. And Henry, I know we were talking during that game where Michigan just couldn't create actual advantages. They were just getting contained at the point of attack. They went away from their motion principles and just settled for post entries for the last 15 minutes of the game. And Hunter Dickinson has been an absolute force all year, but when you get that predictable, the defense is going to react. And I think that was the biggest thing with Gonzaga and maybe why I do tend to prioritize. And again, we keep coming back to Jalen Green. I don't know if it's Jalen Green because I don't know if I would entrust him with that large of an on-ball role to necessarily tilt a defense. Like, if Jalen Green was on Gonzaga, I don't necessarily think the result would have been any different is basically what I'm trying to get at. However, I do think it is worthwhile and there are certain principles that should be applied where Gonzaga was attempting to run this motion-heavy modern offense with three guards who I think we can probably all agree are better off as secondary off-ball guards in Nembhard, Suggs, and Ayayi. And that's not necessarily take away for anything from them individually, but it is worth noting that when you're going up against a team that has the point of attack defenders, and obviously Davion Mitchell is otherworldly in this aspect because of reasons that we mentioned earlier, but when you are going up against a team that can switch like Baylor can and can contain the ball like Baylor can, and there are teams like that in the NBA, it does present a smaller margin for error with these set principles if you don't have someone who can reliably break down the offense, like you said, without a ball screen, without a post touch.
Yeah, I mean, that happened in Illinois too. You know, Loyola just like did the Loyola thing, and we're like, we're gonna take the ball for 30 seconds, and like if we have to shoot an awful shot at the end of the shot clock, so be it. We just don't want you to run on us, and it worked. The flip side of that, though, Jake, is like the it's really hard for any individual player of any on-ball creation ability to overcome general stagnation that those teams faced in the half court. So even if you have like a Jalen Green, even if you have, you know, like what Jordan Clarkson looked like in college, like that's how you buoy those stagnate. Like there were clearly times in the tournament, I'm trying to think of like examples. There were plenty of like teams in the tournament that just like, UCLA is honestly a great example. Like UCLA in the end of close games, just like, all right, Johnny, like go score. And he did every time. And it was hilarious. But that's not reliable. And nothing Johnny got was like open or quality. It was all like eight dribbles into like a contested 17 footer. And he was just making them, like, good for them. But point being, it's kind of impossible to overcome that level of stagnation, regardless of the talent you have on your team. So in my opinion, so it is, it's not like you can have those sort of players, the Jalen Green types, just rolled out and be like, well, we're impervious to offensive stagnation because we have all these guys that can create all the space off the dribble. I still think you're going to run into the same problems because just the level, the way that the basketball is now is like every college team and every NBA team has a bunch of really tall guys with long arms that you can't just dribble through no matter how good you are at dribbling. Like it's just, there's a certain threshold of impossibility there. Some guys are better at it than others, but I do think that stagnation is just generally something you have to avoid conceptually because no one player, no two players can overcome it by themselves.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle.
Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I mean, I kind of would argue that transcendent players can, though. That, like, and if you need transcendent talent to win at a really high level, you know, Kevin Durant is kind of impervious to stagnation,
so is James Harden. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, that's kind of what Kobe Bryant's career was, right? That, like, mm-hmm. the shots were always the same. So I think that if you're talking about transcendent players, which is what I think you're ultimately shooting for in team building, that it is kind of the trump card.
Yeah, I mean, it is a trump card. I just think the threshold for that is higher than people like to believe sometimes in terms that player. Like, I think that the one guy in this class who maybe is that is Cade, and like, then that's it. Like, that's fully it. There's no, I don't see a way that maybe Jalen Green, like maybe Jaden Springer, maybe no way, but like maybe that's it. Like, it's just Cade. So at that point, I'm just saying, like, if you're going to be drafting on that premise of like, well, we can draft this player because he can unstagnate our offense. Unless it's like probably the best player in the draft, it's probably not true.
Yeah, but there are levels to it though. Like if you're not shooting for title contention, there are levels to stagnation proof that could make you a playoff contender. There are a lot of guys. There are a lot of guys in the NBA who can do that.
I think this is all coming from the premise of building a quote unquote championship team. Like, how do I get closest to a championship team? Like, of course, if you are a mid-market team that's missed the playoffs for 12 years in a row, like Minnesota or something, and you like have a shot at a playoff contention, like that's all you're really shooting for. Of course, you can like manufacture that with guys like Jalen Green. But to get to that overarching level, I think it's much harder.
Yeah. And I think that this transitions us nicely into the feasibility of this. I'll go out of order with the outline because I kind of started to answer that question. But like, if you hypothetically have a guy who has the intellectual capacity and the skill capacity to be, because like, I mean, like you acknowledged, like, you're not winning a title without the best player in the league, more or less anyway, or that caliber of player. You have a guy who satisfies the intellectual and skill requirements to be that guy, but you don't have the surrounding roster for whatever reason. Which is not even necessarily like a fault of team building. Like, that's one of the other things we're going to talk about, is like, how often do these guys actually come around that satisfy your requirements? But like, if you have an inadequate roster otherwise, do you try to be this year's Warriors, or like, do you just spam Steph Curry high pick and roll 50 times a game?
That depends on multiple things. The biggest one that comes to mind is like timeline and context. Like, if I had a team of like a bunch of young guys and Steph, like Steph's on the way out.
Say it's just 1 year. Say it's 1 year. You're trying to assemble the best team possible in that year. Your talent is such that you have this one transcendent player who is, you know, I mean, Steph Curry, whatever percentile he is in mm-hmm. on-ball skill and intelligence, it's about as high a combination as you can have. Mm-hmm. And say you have then a surrounding roster of guys who are lower feel.
Just like the current Warriors.
Like, yeah, say you're the current Warriors. Are you spamming high pick and roll with Steph, or are you trying to do what they're doing?
No, if it's like the current year Warriors and I just care about how we do this year, I'm just going to put the ball in Steph Curry's hand as much as possible, minimize everyone else's touches, have it be Draymond in a lot of the on-ball actions, and play out of there and probably just play three shooters around him and hope that they make open shots. At that point, sure, that's how I would do it. But I don't think I think I'd be a pretty bad GM if I was like just playing that way in terms of like thinking for the 1 year sort of like, I don't think it was wise, regardless of how Wiseman turns out or doesn't turn out or what type of player he is really. I think it was unwise for the Warriors to be like, yeah, let's pick Wiseman because he'll maximize the quote unquote maximize the Steph window, because he's like a center with a lob, that's a lob threat that can maybe space, that can play with Steph. Like, that's a little bit of sort of like flawed process to me. I think that you're better off. I don't see a lot of team context beyond like you know, maybe this year's Lakers, this year's Nets, this year's Sixers, maybe. Like, I think you're always 99% of the time, you're better off shooting for long-term viability than short-term success. So I just think that, yeah, at that point, I would be willing to concede, like, yes, for this year's Warriors team to get the most wins possible, Steph should be holding the ball for 20 seconds of every possession. And the other 4 seconds he's not holding it should be the one where the guy's shooting it. So sure, but I think that's just not a way I would ever really, barring a few occasions, design a team or design an offense or a system for a certain team.
And we're going to call that part one because we're going super long. You can follow the pod at Prep2ProPod on Twitter. You can follow Jake at Jake in the Paint. You can follow me at Max A. Carlin. And please check out Henry at Henry W. Ward on Twitter. He is criminally underfollowed. And on his timeline, you'll be able to find a link to the recent stream that he did with PD and links to whatever he's writing, which is always must-read content. So check that out. And we'll be back with part two in a couple days.